Welcome to Bitches on Comics. I'm your host, Essie Fleenor, and I am so pumped to be here for a very special episode with one of my favorite guests we've ever had, and one of my favorite cartoonists, and one of the coolest people, the lovely Véronique Emma Hubois. Thank you for being here as a special guest host. I'm so happy you're here.
Thank you. Yeah, it's me. I'm back. and hopefully, this episode will be one that people will actually talk about and want to share again, because this is technically my third appearance. My first one was my drag character. My second one is the forbidden episode that nobody talks about. So hopefully nobody in this room today gets canceled so that we have to bury this one too. But I'm feeling hopeful. I'm feeling good because our real guest today is Prism Award winning cartoonist Emma Jane, who has done such hits in the past as Trans Girls Hit the Town, Trans Girls Hit the Field, and the brand new Silver Sprocket graphic novel we're here to talk about today, LSBN.
Woo!
You're putting a lot of pressure on me. What if I get canceled today?
You know what? I lied when I was like, we're not here to do hard-hitting journalism. We're going to do just gotcha questions today, Emma. So,
oh no.
Brace yourself. This is the one time the bitches get investigative. Is there anything you want to add to introduce yourself to our listeners who may not be familiar yet?
I'm very nice and I've never done anything wrong. Don't believe the lies. For real though, you're never going to believe this. I am a cartoonist. I have made, wow. I really feel like I should have had this one lined up. The softballest question, which was, tell us literally anything about you.
So today we are here to, predominantly talk about your super cool new graphic novel, LSBN, or Lesbian. It seems like there's some debate about how to say it. I was told by some folks on your publisher team to just say lesbian as quickly as possible. That would work too. So now I go Lesbian. That's my new way of doing it. Or LSBN, these super exciting, oh my gosh. Okay, wait, I have notes about how I describe it. So I say, okay, it's a story about two trans women who are finding each other and falling in sex, potential love with one another. We'll see.
And falling then in sex is quite the...
I mean, they literally fall in the
Yeah, it's a literal that's description true. Of what's on the page. Yeah, that's accurate.
It really feels like a... I don't know. It's like they fell into a big vat of sex. Just a big vat of chemicals called sex. And then they emerge like some sexual joker. I don't know.
Okay, well, now you've just outlined my new comic I'm going to work on.
I'll take it. I'm not touching that one.
Well, you've both blown my Harley Quinn origin comic, so fuck that, right? Thank you. Jesus. Back to the drawing board on that one.
You guys have already got me in stitches. Okay, I'm pulling it together. Okay, so, this awesome story about these two characters coming together is in this backdrop of, there are these huge monsters. You're not allowed to call them monsters anymore. The Colossi, who have been in conflict with humanity. Humanity has developed these big mech suits that are so cool. And, oh, wait, now we have a peace treaty. The mech suits are going to all be retired. So both the characters that we have Polyakov and Commander Tsujimoto. They both work for this LSBN company that is, or organization, I guess is a better way of putting it, that is developing the mech suit. So now they're they're staring down losing their jobs. More than that, they're staring down losing their life's work. And I wanted to know a little bit about the pairing of this sort of intimate story between these two women connecting and having sex and feeling tender feelings for each other and the mech part, or which came first, the trans lesbians or the mech? I don't know. Take the question whatever way you'd like.
Oh, this is a good question. And I think I've answered this in the past, and I worry that I retroactively made up this story. I think it's true. I don't know. I probably wouldn't have made it up because it's not an incredible story or anything. But basically in 2020, Things happened in 2020, if you didn't know. I was feeling kind of sad and lonely, and what better way to cope with that than to watch Neon Genesis Evangelion? Mm-hmm. It lifts the spirits. But anyway, I got to the part of End of Evangelion where I want to say the fucked up part at the end, as if like the whole end isn't super fucked up, but everyone at Nerve HQ is getting goopified, evaporated, getting turned into the big soup, as it were. There's just like this tiny little shot of, I believe it's one of Ritsuko's, not inferiors, like she would be their superior. What do you call that? Subordinates. Ha ha.
I was like, I have no clue.
Subordinates. Like just the last thing she does before she kind of becomes a weird flesh goo is reveal that she has been in love with her commander the whole time. And I was like, wow, why wasn't this whole series about these dykes? That's not true. I didn't actually want that because I like Evangelion as it is. But I was like, okay, what if that did happen? And yeah, I don't know why specifically I wanted to have the mech backdrop. I think part of it was just because I also had this idea where like they made this giant robot they didn't need that cost $3 gazillion or whatever. I don't know what currency they use in this book. Like, I don't know. Robobucks. Wait, is that like Roblox? Is that a thing?
Roblox is a thing, but it's not Mecha. I do find it fascinating that you brought up Evangelion, because when I was reading it, I was like, well, I don't want to just assume Evangelion went into this, because that would be really transphobic of me. Not all of us love that series as much as I do, but it's a big stereotype out there for sure. But I really, yeah, that broadside of me, I know that scene intimately well. Like, it's incredible. It's a beautiful moment in the original End of Evangelion. But I just, you know, I didn't really pick up on any like particular visual cues or anything that reminded me of Evangelion, because the basic setup with the LSBN, that felt to me very Pacific Rim. But then you also have this great side character, I believe her name is DeGroot. Mm-hmm. And she's got like full on Go Nagai hair. Like she has the swoopy like one eye covered that like I know for a fact Blackjack has, but there's a bunch of other ones that do. So there's like a huge classic anime vibe going on here. But like I did not see Evangelion coming, to be honest.
Yeah, there's, oh man, I'm such a poser. You can't tell anyone this. I say on the podcast.
No, we'll definitely keep it on the DL.
I am one of those posers where Evangelion was the first one that I watched. And like, I didn't watch another mech thing for a while. And I still am not like super well-versed in it. So some of those things are like just coincidence. Like the last thing you mentioned, I do not know who that character is. And I feel kind of validated because that means I didn't technically rip anyone off. Oh, that reminds me. There was this one, not actually mech series per se, but have you ever heard of the 2000s, I think kind of obscure anime Shimon?
No.
It is this thing that I heard about that I specifically did not want to watch until I had finished inking LSBN, because I didn't want to just let it influence me in any way. But it's this show about this kind of sky city theocracy, and they're at war with the planet below, whatever, whatever. There's all this really complex lore, but the most important thing is that they have these ships that are piloted by like priestesses or whatever, and they have to be piloted in pairs. And also they are, for some reason that I think they make up an excuse for, but let's be real, was just completely fabricated for this. The ships are piloted by like women kissing each other, which is like...
I think I have a vague sense of this, because it's not the only like just horny mech series, because I believe Darling in the Franxx does something heterosexual that's similar, which is why I would never watch that series. But, you know, like Evangelion at the end of the day, and this is very tired, but it just has to be said, is kind of like the Watchmen of Mecha. It's not like something that's going to engage you to make you want to watch a ton more. It's like the series that kind of blows the whole thing up and says, like, this is all kind of terrible and fucked up at its core. So it's not really like a great entry into Mecha. But I do know that like Gundam Witches or whatever has lesbians, and that's supposed to be fun.
Oh, that's, it's very sweet of you to assume that I didn't absolutely devour that shit up. I feel really bad about Gundam Witch because I don't know if there's been a time when I have been just so acutely aware that I was being marketed to and that it was working. But hey, it worked. And I loved it. I feel like the last third to a quarter of it was, I do not feel like they stuck the landing. I think the last quarter should have like been another season. But yeah, we were talking about, you know, something actually related to my work and not just about anime. Hello.
Listen, we are always welcome to go off on whatever we want. And we needed an anime moment. We needed an anime moment. And I, you know what? I know our listeners, they're going to appreciate it.
Wait, you think your listeners might watch anime?
You know, I have a vague idea. Listen, I actually don't watch very much anime. I watch way too much TV. And so I have to like choose genres to be limited about because otherwise I don't think I'd ever do anything. But now I'm like, well, now I feel like a poser myself. Like I need to watch a bunch of anime. So now I'm like, well, writing down everything y'all been saying. I'm like, okay, this one. And then everyone is like neon. I can't say it.
Just say Ava. You can just say Ava.
Ava. Okay. I know that's like the one. And I'm like, okay, all right, all right, all right. I'll do it. I'll do it. But I also know our listeners will be like, ugh, SE, ugh, poser. No, they won't. They won't. That'd be so weird.
I know. I feel like there's a part of me that needs to like warn you. Like maybe don't watch anime. There's like, it could take over your life. It like, I didn't used to be like this. Like, listen, as a kid, I watched like Yu-Gi-Oh! And Cardcaptor Sakura and had very normal gender feelings about the second one anyway. But like after that, oh fuck, and Digimon. Still have a huge soft spot for that. Anyway, but after that, then I was like out. I'm like, I'm not actually that much more grown up, but like it's just not really a part of my life anymore. But then in fucking 2019, Fire Emblem Three Houses came out and ruined my entire life. And I'm in so deep. It's so messed up. The amount of Edelgard memorabilia in my office around me as we speak is just shameful.
It feels a little bit like this is like as close as I'll probably get. It's like getting into the Transformers comics, I am like, I came here for smashy, you know, cars that turn into robots. And now I'm like, okay, listen, the politics on this planet are very complex. Sit down. Let me explain. And my wife is like, I don't want to know this. Please stop talking to me.
But that's like, that's the interesting stuff to me. Like I do like shoving the action figures together. Whatever, whatever. Once in a while, but mostly like you got to have the requisite angst.
Oh, definitely.
And also, like I also have this very specific sickness. It's not a sickness, but I'll call it a sickness where I think like the best scene in any piece of fiction is when it's just like a bunch of dudes. You only know like who two of the characters are, but they're all gathered around a big map and they're talking about which parts of the map are their friends and which part of the friends will not come to their aid. And like, I don't know any of the locations they're saying. I'm just letting it wash over me. And it just like, it feels so good. I don't know why.
No, I can see that. I can see that. I like it. I like it. Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, I guess we should come back to LSBN. And you know, I've been thinking so much about it and I've read it a couple times now. I find it when I'm really excited about a comic, sometimes I have a hard time finding questions because I just want to be like, so page 8, this thing happens. Tell me everything. But I don't want to just give you a Chris Farley style interview. I would like, isn't that cool? did you like that? Was that fun? You know, even though that's a vibe too. You know, I'm thinking a lot about how in the plot for LSBN, miscommunication, missed social cues, et cetera, play like a pretty big role, you know, missing each other, miscommunicating. And I was thinking about how Sugimoto and Polyakov make mistakes and get confused and run away from each other. Or I guess mostly Polyakov runs away from Sugimoto. And then Sugimoto runs to Polyakov. You know what? Read the comic. But, you know, they also share and they have these moments because of these mistakes where they have a deeper connection. And so, I, you know, go with this wherever you feel right. But, you know, I'd love to hear about why you chose to tell a story this way. What is it about missing each other and then connecting beyond making mistakes or hurting one another that is so important in your storytelling?
I think part of it is just because, oh no, this is going to sound more antagonistic than I wanted to. I don't mean antagonistically, but, and I'm very wary of making my stuff too saccharine, which feels weird because, you know, generally it's pretty sweet and nice stuff, which also is kind of ironically is so opposite of my default state. Like everything I write, it kind of starts off as like the worst case scenario version of whatever the story ends up being. But like, my girlfriend is such an optimist and she's trying to help me. No, she's not actively trying to make me an optimist, but like it makes me want to be more of an optimist than I am. So I don't know. Maybe it does just kind of come from that. I just always want to assume the worst, and the stuff I make is a conscious act to try to believe in something better, if that makes sense.
I love it. Yeah. I identify with that. I tend to write pretty sad and messed up stories, but there are always these pockets where I think I'm trying to do something similar, where it's like, you know, trans people connecting in a space where, you know, we live in a world that's highly antagonistic to us, but finding ways to connect with each other and create genuine meaning outside of that framework.
Well, see, this is why I think you guys are rubes for doing long form work, because like when I do a 3-panel strip, it's whatever it is today. And then tomorrow it's something else. So I don't have these concerns. But no, seriously. Yeah, I don't think that anybody could tag you as being particularly saccharine and stuff, because I think, you know, the key thing is that there's one of the big things in, you know, between the two trans girls comics and LSBN is that they do, like, they focus on kind of interpersonal conflicts and emotional conflicts that I think something that would be a bit more saccharine or whatever just would avoid or wouldn't tackle in the way that these comics do. Like, you know, it would just be, you know, in your rom-coms and stuff, like, I mean, in by your, I mean, like the general you, the outside world, like when you have a rom-com, it's like there's some goofy happenstance that happens that the two of them, the two people who end up hooking up, like have this misunderstanding and then they think the entirely wrong thing about each other, right? Like we've been doing this since Pride and Prejudice, at least. It's a very long time. It's too long. But what I find... No, yeah, sorry to get all Grant Morrison on you, but, you know, the 19th century and a novel has been, you know, holding us hostage since the 19th century. But there's more of a, like, emotional sort of verisimilitude or honesty in these comics because it is actually people's, like, simmering, you know, whether, like, their internal problems or how they try to relate to people in the outside world. It's... To me, it's kind of the opposite of saccharine that way. It really grasps the nettle in the way that even someone like Tori Peters would do, I think.
Well, thank you for saying so. I worry about it a lot. I don't know, because I feel like there are a lot of trans comics, I guess, just comics about trans people that are like only doom and gloom, which I'm going to be honest, I do fucking love because I feel that. But I also feel like there is a lot where it is also just like everything's super nice. Or I don't know. I guess I've never really read an instance of a trans character and like, Big Two comics or something like that, where I felt very seen, I suppose. I don't know. I'm not sure. But like, how do you create a trans character in a story that is not explicitly about transness? Like, it feels weird to just completely ignore it, in that it wouldn't matter if they were trans or not. But also, a lot of times it just feels like we're stuffing these stereotypical trans narratives into other stories, and that's not like satisfying either. And I won't say, like, I don't know, LSBN is revolutionary in that respect. It kind of is a book that is not predicated on transness, but I don't know. I don't think I even have a question, or I was answering a question there. I was just thinking.
Well, I think you're pointing, in a sense, like, to me anyway, because there is a lot of confusion in the market and media. Where do we take representation, and what do we want it from? Because you'll go to them, and there'll be this piece that says, we want trans mediocrity now, and stuff like that. But I mean, you know, Harney Knapp said something in an interview recently, where she said there's a lot of stuff out there right now that's like queer in content and not in form. And I think that speaks to a lot of film and a lot of things in general. But I do definitely feel that about like superhero comics and stuff, because like, you know, in that field, it is very reduced to this is a side character because we don't think we can sell a lead, or like this is in, you know, there's like a dysphoria metaphor or whatever. Or it's like some version of that Green Lantern comic, you know, where like the gay guy got beat up and then Kyle goes and beats up the guys that beat him up. And it's like, yay, we're allies because we use violence. You know, but it's just, but those things, like they have trans characters in them. But they're not drawing on any of like the rich history of like symbols or ways of living or art or anything that constitute the trans experience or has constituted the trans experience. Like, I mean, if you go back to like Rachel Pollack on Doom Patrol, like, yeah, like she based a character on Kate Bornstein, right? Or partially. And you see these things in like the little slogans on Caligula's outfit and stuff. I think I said the character's name wrong, but there's, you know, there's bringing parts of this tradition, these ideas into it. And we've just kind of, through the way that contemporary like film criticism and fandom works, lost the idea of like how to be lyrical and to bring these things that aren't explicitly, this person doesn't identify as the gender they were born as, or this person has these parts and they kiss people with the same parts, you know, like there's putting the thing in the place, and then there's animating it with like the rich texture and like history and stuff to which it belongs. And I think there's such a disconnect from all of that. And what I'm saying is that we need to bring queer citationalism back, I guess.
I'm on the same fucking page as you, Varun Akema. Because I actually had written down, we had a chance to talk to Rachel Pollack about Caligula and her body of work before she passed, rest in peace. On episode 58, that's the one we talked to her, and we talked to her about how she created trans characters. And she was like, you know, I get this question a lot. And for her, she kind of like laughed. And she was like, well, my characters are always based in part on people I know. That's why they feel real, because I am trans and I live around and am in community with trans people. And she talked about the button you mentioned. And I wanted to add that in, because that's something I've been thinking about so much with your work, Emma Jane, is how real the characters feel, even despite being in like a mech universe, you know, like they're clearly not real, but they feel like lived in characters, like people in my communities, people I've talked to. And so I just wanted to add that in as you're talking about it, and sort of responding to what Veronique Emma has said.
Thank you. That is like explicitly what I strive for, I think, just because I hate reading a story about a trans character. I'm not like in a, this isn't what the real trans experience is way, but it just feels like this doesn't feel like the reality of the trans people I know, if that makes sense. And that seems like a fraught phrase, which is a fun phrase to say, a fraught phrase. Because there are people that, I think all the time about, are you familiar with the visual novel We Know the Devil?
Oh my God, yes. I thought I was going to be the first person to bring that up.
I was kind of floored when I heard from people that apparently there was this kind of a small group of people who are really like, harshly criticizing We Know the Devil just because, well, their argument was, this is not the experience I had, so therefore this is wrong and it's invalid. And that is ludicrous to me. I cannot comprehend that angle. But there's also a difference between that and being like, this is not my experience, but it also doesn't feel like the experience of any of the other trans people I've met in my community would ever have. And what that comes down to is kind of a very sterile feeling of representation, even though I hate the word representation, because usually when you say representation, it feels like it's coinciding with that kind of shallowness that we were talking about before, you know?
Yeah, I guess that kind of drives me a little nuts because, like, yeah, I know we didn't all have fundamentalist Christian backgrounds, but we know the devil is very esoteric and lyrical in the ways that I was kind of talking about. And it just kind of like people, I guess, get mad at seeing ideas of like negative, negative self-embodiment, which is what's going on with all of those characters, right? And kind of like digging through the muck of the darkest parts of themselves to come through the other side. And so, of course, they have the Satan figure to kind of embrace that and to, you know, show this embodiment. And I do have a strip where I reference, like, I don't think it's Venus's final form. I can't remember who it is, but one of, you know, where I briefly pop into one of the final forms of the three characters. I think it's Jupiter. It's the one with all the eyes, right? But it's just kind
Hell
of,
yeah.
You know, like negative identification, like, you know, it causes a lot of discomfort. And broadly, societally, I don't want to say we, I hate we statements, but a lot of people have kind of lost the ability to sit with discomfort and recognize that, yeah, I mean, if you didn't go through that, like negative identification as like a trans experience, I guess, like, bravo. You know, you put in the Konami code somehow, because I feel like most of us do go through a phase like that. And I think maybe these people are angry because I don't want to psychoanalyze them, but I think it's kind of like they don't want to sit through the discomfort of there being these stages or there being these other modes of being. But it's like, this is why we need as many trans creators as we can get over the transome. You know, it's like we need all of, you know, we need this to be like, I don't even know what I'm saying, but like there just has to be so many more iterations, right? Because like if you get back to the superhero thing, you're like, oh, we have the first trans superhero, we have the first lesbian superhero and stuff. And so, you know, people get mad that like Batwoman is like this sexy leather dyke and stuff. And it's just like they're mad because it's the only lesbian they're seeing and they're not a sexy leather dyke. Whereas the sexy leather dykes are like, fuck you, get someone else. So, you know, we need to be able to embrace each other's points of view and bring as many points of view as we can to this.
Yeah, I extremely agree. And yeah, that's something that, I mean, I especially like about We Know the Devil, also love about Heaven Will Be Mine. It's just like, I don't know, being queer is agony sometimes. It's very unsexy to say, but...
Not if you're Clive Barker.
I was going to say, depends on the room.
Point taken. Yeah, I know We Know the Devil hit me extra hard because the specificity with which it attacked me is so, so severe. Just based on like setting and circumstances, like, okay, yeah, this is exactly the kind of experience I had growing up. And damn, the little hairband detail. Ooh, stressful. Anyway, we don't have to talk about that. That's like a super bummer. Anyway.
Hey, I enjoy a bummer. Maybe that makes me sick, but you know what? I'll take my sickness.
I love tragedies. I
oh,
really...
Oh, God, yeah.
I wish I could only write them because they give me such... There's so much release, like... I don't know. Hoping that everything's going to be fine feels very exhausting. And just having this space where it is like, oh, we don't need to worry anymore because everything horrible that could possibly happen is happening.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of release and beauty in that for me. This is really not how I thought this interview was going to go.
Oh, listen, I don't think any interview goes the way anyone expects on this podcast. Like, we're like, wait a minute. Now you said something really deep and painful. I want to go back to that. You know, it's that's just how we are. But no, I mean, I really identify with that. I remember trying to explain to people why I really loved super violent films and super violent comics. And you know, when I say people, I mean my therapist. And, you know, she was like, that's great. I mean, like, if you like it, you like it. And I was like, you know, I think it's honestly, like, I've survived so much violence at the hands of others. It just is kind of nice to see it made so neon, so silly. Like, when Deadpool is, you know, killing a bunch of bad guys, like, those aren't people. They're, like, just something someone drew in the background. It doesn't feel the same. I don't know. It does feel to me like it gives me some way to expurgate or investigate, or I don't even know, some kind of gate, I guess, my feelings and my experiences of trauma and violence, where it's like, I like it. I just like it. You know, it makes me happy in a weird way.
And I guess I will circle back to End of Evangelion again. Hot damn, did I love that movie. I guess especially in the first three Rebuild films, my friend just like really elegantly expressed the reason I had liked Evangelion as a whole that I didn't really put into words until I heard them say this, but it's like, it is this perfect embodiment of being in this state where you are too terrified to do anything or make a change in your life. And the moment you try to like set boundaries for yourself or take any action, everything turns to complete shit.
Mm.
And it's just so devastatingly good at that.
Mm. I like that.
My work isn't like that sad.
I know. It kind of feels like we're all getting pretty deep here. There's something that both of you said at different points that I just want to talk about a little bit more, because it really resonated with me and was something that came up in Pseudo Slut Transmission, which is the idea that we need more stories by trans people. At one point in Pseudo Slut Transmission, early in the comic, the main character is on a dating app and she writes to the other person, there isn't enough work about trans people by trans people. So I want to help fix that. And that felt like such a human thing. I think so many of us who are creatives who are trans, I don't know. I mean, maybe we're just silly little fools who like are compelled to tell our little stories. But that's what stood out to me too. And what you said, Veronique Emma, about, you know, there have to be more stories. There have to be more voices, because when we end up in a situation where we have trans people saying, well, that's not my experience, so that's not real, that can be really damaging for the people who it is real for. I also grew up in a very Christian environment. And even though I haven't seen the thing that y'all are talking about, the devil something, we know the devil.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Actually, there's this YA book that is called Hell Followed With Us that is... It sounds like they might pull on some similar threads, probably very differently given that it's a YA book. But, you know, there's a lot of really intense dealing with religious trauma for a trans character, and I should say trans characters. And, you know, I guess my point is, I think it's nice to be at a point in time where there is more of a proliferation, where even the two of you who are both telling trans stories in different ways can like be on this podcast and like talk to me, and I'm so happy. But I also think there's got to be space for like, yeah, like there can be really sweet, gentle, queer and trans representation. And I love that. Like that's lovely. And there can be, you know, stuff that's a little sexier, but maybe also fun, which is where I'd kind of put your work, Emma Jane, but you tell me where I'm wrong. You know, and then there can be stuff that's like introspective and sexy and sad and hopeful. And that's, you know, I think about a lot with your work, Veronique Emma Huban. You know, there's so many people we've had on the pod who've talked about their experiences as trans creators and what it means to tell their version of their story. And I guess I'm very hopeful that we can continue, especially through small presses, especially through self-publishing, web comics, all of that, to have more proliferation of those voices, so that instead of feeling like we have to go to the big two or we have to go to the big five publishers, which I think now is like the big three. I can't keep track of that monopoly nightmare. you know, we don't have to go to these big mainstream things and say, well, please, sir, may I have some, you know, for lack of a better term, representation? Mm. Please, sir, could you show my life to the world? We can do it for each other and we can see each other. And I don't know, this was a very long-winded way of saying, I guess I'm just really happy that both your works are in the world. And that, again, so many folks I've been so lucky to talk to on the podcast, you know, that their trans stories are out there too, because I think, and I honestly can't remember who said it because I was so like in the moment, but one of you was like, that's what we need, is we need more of these voices. And that to me is like, that's my banner, you know, that I like have over my head. I'm like, more trans voices, more trans voices. So I don't know. I think as much as it's weird because I think it's funny to be someone who writes such lovely and sweet and funny stories. And you're like, but I like the darkness. And I really appreciate that because I think that's kind of me too. Is I like, my reading is like all over the map. You know, I read YA, I read real dark horror stuff, you know, I watch all kinds of stuff. And I think all of it makes me feel a little bit more human as a trans person when I see trans voices, trans actors on in front of the camera, trans writers behind the camera. I don't know. I think it just makes me feel like there is some space for me and there's some space for the complexity of who I am, in that I am someone who's been through some dark shit. But do I every day sit in my trauma and cry? Like, no, I don't right now. I've done some healing. I've done some work around my gender dysphoria. I've done some work around my childhood. Like right now, you know, talk to me in 2 weeks, y'all. I could be right back in that pit. Who knows? But today, you know, I'm talking to two other trans folks. I'm feeling the connectivity. I'm feeling hopeful. So I guess that's all to say. Like what I heard is the difference between like going to a piece and saying, that's not my experience as a trans person, so that's bad. Feels very controlling versus coming to it with, you know, that might not be my experience, so we need more trans stories. That feels very open and very, I guess, open-ended in a really exciting way.
Yeah, but I mean, like, and it's not always necessarily being precious about our own experiences and telling those stories, because like the strip that I put up today, none of that happened to me, right? I mean, obviously, I've never met Emily Deschanel, but you know, I think it was actually Maddie Lubchansky who did this first. And there's like this situation of being confronted by a TERF who's like, when you die, they're going to find a male skeleton. And I don't know how the Lubchansky one ends, but the third Emma, the one who's not here, pseudonym Jones, did, you know, her own riff on it. And it's at a coffee shop. And, you know, this TERF has this forked tongue. And you know, Emma just responds with this whole big rant. And so then I was like, okay, well, these two cool people have done this. I'm just going to jump on the bandwagon too, you know? And I moved it to a public washroom because that's where the, what do you call it? Oh, what is her name? Fun Home. Alison Bechtel, the Dykes to Watch Out For strip, the second most famous one, is actually about like a cis lesbian getting misgendered in a washroom and a trans woman standing up for her. Roughly speaking, it's a little more complicated than that. But so, you know, in my version, you know, I get, you know, the same kind of TERFery, you know, they're going to find a male skeleton. But then, you know, Emily Deschanel, who played Dr. Temperance Brennan on Bones, shows up and she's like, that's anthropologically incorrect, you know. And so I don't say a goddamn thing, you know, I don't get my moment of catharsis. But it's just like, you know, we can like take on board, you know, other people's experiences. Like, you know, you don't want to, you know, be thieving other people's lives. But I think it's fun to incorporate those experiences and be open to them. And I think we should riff on each other's stuff and just kind of, you know, be open to these other approaches and not be too precious about our own backgrounds and our work.
I love that. I'm curious for you, Veronique, Emma, does that tie back to what you were saying with queer citationalism?
Yeah. Yeah, 100%.
Now I'm like, we're all in a tapestry woven together.
Exactly.
And then I cry. Aww. I'm a sensitive little soul.
Big giant get along sweater.
And we're all have to be in it.
Hey everybody, earlier today I made myself a sandwich and I thought to myself, if I could rate and review this sandwich, I would give it 5 stars. And I would say, this sandwich is so incredible. It was the best sandwich I've had literally in days. And it was everything I wanted it to be. And that would be a positive review that would help me see what audience responses were to my sandwich. And, you know, it would just be really a helpful system. I wonder if there's another situation where rating and reviewing would come in handy. Oh, huh. Oh my God. No, what? You could rate and review this podcast, and then that helps us find our audience, and it helps us find whatever we've lost. It helps us find what we've lost.
Helps us find our socks, our keys, our cell phone. People don't talk about it enough. When you rate and review, it really changes someone's life.
Yeah, it's going to change my life, that's for sure. And we like to read the reviews, you know, the ones that are positive, that say soothing and nice things.
5 stars. We'll give you 5 stars as a listener. You give us 5 stars as a podcast.
5 sandwiches. This podcast, let's face it, is 5 delicious sandwiches.
And there's this nice explicit sex scene, maybe halfway through around there, where, you know, Polyakov and Sugimoto are getting down inside us, the soon-to-be decommissioned mech. So at a time when so much, right, there is so much anti-sex sentiment. There's so much puritanism around, oh, sex shouldn't even need it. We're not going to talk about that. We're just going to talk next to that, which is, you know, our media has become so filled with, and I can never remember the person who coined this. They were talking about the Marvel films and they said, it's a world where everyone is beautiful and no one is fucking. Yeah. And I was like, fuck, that's a really good way of putting that. So it just stays in my brain. And I'm curious, why do you think it's necessary to show specifically trans women having sex in a comic? And yeah, that's all I'm going to say.
My off the cuff, don't tell anyone I said this answer is, it's hot.
Agreed.
The intellectual answer is just like, I don't know. I did have a lot of trepidation about it, because sexuality while you are a trans woman is a scary thing, aside from like all the internal stuff and how fraught that can be emotionally, but also just the perception of, you know, predation, I guess I would say. You know, it's, I don't need to tell you guys about moral panic about, you know, trans women preying on women in women's bathrooms, et cetera, et cetera. Tale as old as time. But it's just, I don't know. It's hard to experience like romantic and sexual desire as a trans woman and not have this little niggling part in the back of your brain that's like, oh no, am I right? Am I being a predator? But like, no, you're not. You're having normal human emotions. And I don't know. I think it's why I want to show trans people having sex. A, because yeah, it's hot and it's fun to draw, et cetera, et cetera. But also, I don't know, it's just normal, you know? It feels like some people cannot conceive the fact that trans people have sex and like it's consensual and fun and not weird. And like sometimes you have hangups about stuff, sometimes you don't. It's a big complicated mess, but has very little to do with, like, I don't know, being a predator. You know what I'm saying?
Well, there's just kind of like no space in the cis imaginary for like trans sex that doesn't involve them in some way, right? And I mean, I think this applies to other marginalized groups and stuff, but there's just these particular ideas, and that predation you're talking about takes different forms, because you can go to, I don't know, Silence of the Lambs, right, or whatever. Or you can go to all of these current multifluous moral panics, because you've got the groomers on the one end. You've got, you know, these ideas of, you know, that came out of the UK of like trans women forcing cis women to have sex with them. And it's like a large part of that is just there is not an idea, a public image of trans women with their own sexualities that don't revolve around like cis men particularly, right? And so it's kind of like one of the biggest things that we have to do to fill in those gaps. But one thing that really struck me about LSBN and those scenes is that like they hint at the broader like sexual dynamic between the two that could emerge and like what their preferences seem to be. And it's just, there's a lot left on the table. And you're like, well, what direction would this take? Because when you have something like Sunstone, like we are very intimately aware of what those two are up to and what they want to be doing, because there's like, I don't know, 8 or 9 volumes of it. But like, there's just so much left on the table in LSBN. And I don't mean this as a criticism at all, but like, it's this you know, it's a decently long comic. Like, it's 80 something pages. Like, it's not a zine. But it's so micro focused in this moment of time between these two people. But there is like such a huge armature of like both their internal selves that we don't see manifest, and also like the world itself, because this is about a war that never really happened, right? And you kind of see these monsters in the background, and there's like in the extra bits you get the triple woman, which kind of reminded me of something that might come out of, you know, We Know the Devil. But I guess like I'm really, really curious as to your thought process of making this like iceberg comic. But it's just like, it's like the ice cube at the top of the iceberg, because there's just so much else that you could kind of know is out there on the periphery, but just never gets touched, never gets used.
I think a lot of that comes down to my preferences for what I like about sci-fi, I suppose. Like, I've never enjoyed like Star Wars in any capacity, because I am so much more interested in not like a grand overarching plot. I'm much more interested in thinking about, in these, I don't know, fantastical circumstances, how does that impact the day-to-day lives of the people who have to live in those spaces? And man, I really want to talk about the thing I'm working on next, but I'm not going to.
You won't do what Rachel Pollack did.
I will do my damnedest. I do just have like a slate of ideas and things that I'm working on that basically boil down to, given X sci-fi conceit, what Y dyke drama emerges.
Mm.
And that is a space I'm very excited to play in. Man, my next thing is so much better than anything I've ever made.
Well, you always want to believe that. You always want to believe that and be fired up about it. But I mean, and it's not like you'll fail, but then I think, hopefully, I mean, I do this sometimes. I go back and I look at my old stuff and I was like, God damn, how did I do that? You know, but you do always want your next thing to be your best thing.
And hopefully I feel that way forever, you know?
I hope so too. I hope that for all of us. You know what? I'm putting that out there. I hope that for all of us. I'm feeling that vibe on a book I'm working on too right now. So I'm sending the waves to all of us.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah. You know, Emma Jane, when I think about your works, one of the things that really jumps out at me is and I'm going to borrow a work from Véronique Emma-Hubois, which is the verisimilitude of the dialogue. It feels like a conversation I'd overhear my friends having. Strange if they were talking about mech. I would be like, yo, what is happening? But, you know, people weave in and out of topics. It isn't straightforward. They aren't straight to the point, which I think there's a lot of pressure in dialogue writing and fiction to really tighten it. And people are meandering motherfuckers. And so I love the way that, you know, they're talking about, you know, they're talking about transphobia or gender dysphoria, but then they're talking, then they're projecting their pain on someone else the next moment. Then they're talking about whatever they're working on. Then they're fighting. Then they're forgiving. Then they get deeper in their conversation and they connect at a deeper level. And I'm, you know, I would just love to hear about how, like, what dialogue means to you in your comics. What, if there's like some philosophy or some way you harness it, but also just about how you learn to really put such real dialogue on the page. Because I do think there are a lot of teachers and others who will tell people the right way to do dialogue. And frankly, I think most people aren't that great at dialogue. But yours is so, it's so real.
That is like one of the nicest things anyone can ever say about me. Thank you. But I suppose part of the nature of the things I work on is that they are short form. I cannot live off of comics. There's no way in hell I can afford to do it full time. So whatever I'm making, I'm doing in off hours, which means I have to limit the scope of the thing I do if I want to release something more than once every 6 years or whatever. And because of that, it's funny that you brought up the tightening up thing, because that actually is what I've try to do with everything I write. Try to get the most out of as little as I can, just because of that length constraint. And part of that is, I guess I would think about this one thing. I heard an anecdote. I think it was something Dr. Seuss said. I could be bullshitting, but it was a children book author. And they said something like, I don't know, your approach to creating a children's book is wrong because with a children's book, every individual page needs to be a chapter. And whether you agree with that philosophy or not, that mindset really is something I took to heart, where I'm thinking about, okay, every single interaction in this comic has to achieve something. Like, okay, not that there aren't throwaway gags or whatever, but it needs to reveal something about the world that the reader doesn't know, or read, or reveal like a nuance of the character that is speaking that also isn't them just explicitly saying a certain thing about themselves. It's, I don't know, trying to thread a needle of subtlety where, I don't know, sometimes you will read characters that will say exactly what you're thinking in a way that feels very fake, but at the same time, you don't want to make something so subtle that no one can pick up on it. And it's really hard to pin down, and it's something I think you need to just mess around with and get a feel for, I suppose.
Is there like a way you know when you've sort of threaded that needle well? Like, is there a reaction you have to it, or is it sharing it with other people? Or like, you know, when do you know you're like, yeah, I got it?
I don't.
That's so real.
I'm winging it. Man, I want to sound so smart and be like, ah, yes, my process. No, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. As much as I can say, here is what I'm thinking, it's all about kind of feeling it out.
So how do you know when to stop? Like, when to stop doing a new take on that piece of dialogue, or when to stop? Like, is it a deadline? Does a deadline help you get there? Or I'm just curious.
I don't know why I stop, because by all means, I should just work on polishing the same tiny thing that I'm working on forever, because I'll never feel like it's good enough.
That's too real. We have to publish things.
But at the same time, like, I don't have deadlines per se. Like, when I was working with Diskette Press, it really was the kind of thing where like, oh, I finished this thing. Please print it. And, you know, since it is a press literally run by my friends, they're like, okay. But even now, working with Silver Sprocket, there are deadlines we can sort of feel out and have things we're shooting for, but they really aren't a publisher that is like, we need everything to be finished by this date because it is going to be sold on this date. Mm. And like, there is some of that, but it's not like there is this pressure to kill yourself to get this deadline met. So that made it even more ambiguous of an answer by saying that. But ultimately, this is morbid, but I think about that I'm going to die a lot.
Same. I don't know. Every time you go and you say something, you're like, oh, this might be a little wild. I'm like, well, I completely agree. So perhaps we are both wild. I don't know.
Sometimes I think about like, okay, if I release a comic every year and a half, I'm going to calculate the number of comics I'm able to make before I die.
Oh,
and then
wow.
That will feel like a small number. And it's like, damn, do I really want to spend time on this one? Is this going to be one of the ones that I've spent my limited time on? And I don't know if I recommend that as a way to live, but it sure does help you get to the place where you're like, okay, I've worked on this enough and it just needs to be what it is.
Mm. Well, I think that perspective, like, I don't know if it's, you know, psychologically healthy or whatever. But
almost
like,
certainly not.
No, but it is a solid standing critique of like how the comic book industry works, because like, yeah, obviously you do want to be working in a situation where you have the time and space to let a project breathe. Like you could working with like Diskette or Silver Sprocket, but it gets back to what you were saying in the same, you know, kind of segment where it's like, oh yeah, but like, this is not like, I can't live off this. Right. And so like, this is kind of a sentiment that people who have worked in the more professionalized side of comics, you know, have been saying in recent years, where it's like, you have a certain amount of pages that you can do lifetime wise, career wise. And the pace at which a monthly book in the big two or what have you works, you know, makes that more, I guess, physically dangerous, really, in terms of like risking injury, risking, injury or any other like long-term health issues that go along with that. Like, what's a reasonable pace? Because like the crazy thing about the big two model is they've already like mechanized it and separated it in such a brutal way, right? Because like we both just call ourselves cartoonists because we just draw our own shit. We let our own shit, so on and so forth. But like there's these roles they slot you into. You're a penciler, you're an inker. I mean, that doesn't really exist anymore, but let's just say, you know, colorist, flatter, which, you know, has emerged more in recent years, letterer. And they still, so you they've split, divided the labor into these like highly specialized, like, you know, Fordian roles, but they're still pumping out work, you know, at like a pace that is like physically unsustainable for everybody involved. And it's just like what's going on, you know, because you can also get into the graphic novel market, right? Which is something I talked a lot about with European cartoonists a few years ago. And that's the game of like, here's your advance. You're not going to make any money on this until you earn back the advance. And so in Europe, they just throw a glut of, they just publish tons of shit, give tons of people advances. And your marketing window is so tiny that you just end up always trying to earn back your advance and never seeing a profit on any of your books unless you're a huge creator. So it's just like, where do we find, like, where are we ever going to find a way that like cartoonists can just be cartoonists, you know, without, I don't know, breaking down in a decade or two? It's, I haven't seen a sustainable model yet.
Yeah, me neither. It's just, I don't know, it breaks my heart every day whenever I see another cartoonist I love and respect, like describing some new problem their body has, just because like the amount that they need to draw. And it really, it killed a more innocent part of me, the part of me that like dreamed of doing this for a living someday. And I feel like I kind of had to make this choice where, what does being a cartoonist mean to me as far as like what level I want to work on? And there was part of me for a long time that was like, I wanted to say fuck it and quit any day job and just throw myself at it until I made it. Because this mindset where it's like, well, if I don't have any other choice and it's the only way, then maybe I will push myself hard enough to make it. When in reality, that's bullshit. It just doesn't work that way. So when it comes down to like, well, I could destroy my body for less than living wage working on projects that I probably am not completely passionate about, or I could instead work 40 hours a week, which is kind of a slog, and shove all my cartooning into a couple hours of free time that I'm able to squirrel away. It's not the answer I wanted, but it's the one I landed on, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, when I started transcription, it was in 2020. I live in Canada, and we had a program that basically, it was almost a UBI, like it was close to that. But it was basically like an enhanced unemployment insurance, you know, that let people stay home, you know, for a few months. And so I had about 6 months where, you know, that problem was solved and I could just draw and draw and draw and draw, you know. So like, I've seen it, you know, and I think obviously the pandemic showed us in a lot of ways, like in the States. I mean, I'm an American citizen, I'm a dual citizen, but I live in Canada. But it's just kind of like there was this brief moment where we recognized that, you know, the FDR, the New Deal, like that thing's functional. It's still functional. It's still possible. You can still do those things. But just the politics of it, you know, and the death grip that the right wing has on these things keeps it from happening, because you'll see this again and again. They did it in Stockton, where Ramon Villalobos is from. They did a UBI pilot. You see these things all the time and they always work. And anybody who's on it in the arts, like you get to feel that. You get to see what it's like to be like, this is what happens when I can just create. And it's all possible. It's all out there in that sense. But it's just, it's the political willpower and it sucks.
Yeah. And not that it would make all of the pain to your body worth it, but kind of the shit flavored icing on the cake is that, you know, I've known cartoonists who have gotten to make graphic novels and it's the one they pitched and the one they wanted to make. But by the time it got across the finish line and, I don't know, going through the editorial process of like editors who have only worked on prose and don't really work on comics and don't understand it as a medium and what, especially with queer stuff, publishers are willing to put out. Basically, it has to be very saccharine YA or just fun home again. And apparently they will just kind of funnel whatever your hopes were into kind of one of those two categories. So you're just left with artists that, I don't know, are broke, injured, and they got to create a bastardized version of the thing that they actually wanted to make. And it's just fucking sucks.
Yeah, there's a great episode of Gender Reveal. And the guest was the, I can't remember if they were the writer, artist, or both, of like the quick and easy guide to sex and disability. And they talked to Tuck in a lot of detail about how, like what happened with the publisher on the other side, what the editing notes looked like, and kind of, I guess, what the overall profitability of the thing was. And it just kind of like, on the other end of things, like for us as cartoonists, for us as the workers, you know, like it's unfair and it sucks to us. But like, I was thinking of this kind of from the reader perspective. I look at this and it's like, I see these things that need to get to market, right? I mean, it's great, the fun fiction that I do, that you do, but sometimes, you know, there's like these kind of categories of nonfiction work, you know, or like, you know, Archie's Quick and Easy Guide to They, Them Pronouns. You see these series of works, you see this stuff that needs to get out there, you know, information needs to get communicated, and you want to be proud that this happened. But you look at this stuff and you're just like, it's a whole other side to representation where it's just like, what are people being put through in order to get this vital stuff out there, right? And it just creates a whole other ethical, you know, tangle. You're not gonna say, you know, don't go pick up this comic or whatever, but you're just like, you know, who's reaping the rewards of looking like, you know, they're progressive or support diverse voices or whatever that speak of the week is, you know? And I mean, this even happens in superhero comics, like Cena Grace has talked very explicitly, you know, cause like I looked at that Iceman comic and I was like, I don't know. I don't really get this. It's not great, but I'm like, I'm glad people are happy that Bobby's gay and, you know, Cena's getting out there. But then you hear what he has to say about the homophobia internally at Marvel. And it's just, it gets to that point, like you're saying, it's like, is the juice worth the squeeze? You know, are like, and then reviewers and the public who don't know this, you know, who are enjoying this stuff, and they're like, yay, we made this big win. We're out here getting the material out. But then it's just like, yeah, but at what cost? And it's been invisibilized so much because you don't have so many cartoonists or writers or artists or colorists who are coming out and saying like, yeah, this was the actual toll, because they're worried about their careers. So there's just, yeah, it's a mess. You know, when you talk about, you know, hating the term representation, I kind of feel like that backdrop of exploitation on the publisher side is a big part of it.
And somehow we've managed to, I don't know, loop back around to why I drew two trans women having sex in my comic. Part of it is because this sounds like so stupid and edgelord, but it's like the man wouldn't want me to publish this. But there is an aspect of that to it because, you know, I am far from the first person to say something like this, but, you know, conservative people freaking out and like trying to ban books because, I don't know, two women look longingly at one another for 2 seconds. Like, I don't know. The people that are going to hate you for your queer shit are going to hate you no matter what, or how like chastely you present it. So fuck it. Let's fuck.
Fuck it.
I guess.
Fuck it. Let's fuck. I love it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess my perspective on it is like that scene from Mad Men where I don't know who the second character is because I didn't watch very much of the show, but you know, Don's kind of standing there in the elevator and this guy says to him, you know, I feel sorry for you. And Don turns and he looks at him and he says, I don't think about you at all. Because you can't. I mean, like, I guess I've been there, you know, when like when the orbital death ray still existed, when Kiwi Farms was still on the internet. Yeah, sometimes that to me was viscerally terrifying, you know, because I have like, I don't know. I don't think anybody who like knows their shit is going to read my comics and say, oh my God, Emma did something really crazy in this comic. But things that, you know, kind of were pushing my personal boundaries, you know, in terms of like exploring sex and exploring like those questions you were having about, you know, intimacy and predator myths and stuff. And like, I would, you know, I've done strips that do things like sexualize HRT. And it just kind of like, you know, it's a very secular thing, but it's like, am I feeding back into like some Zucker shit or like Ray Blanchard? Like, am I looping back around to feeding the autogynephilia stuff, you know? And, you know, especially doing lesbian trans stuff. And so sometimes I'm like, if I put this out on the internet and the wrong idiot sees it, you know, is the Kiwi Farms death ray going to come for me? Because like, I know people, I know I think I only know maybe one cartoonist who's been targeted by that whole thing for what they drew. But I know other people, you know, trans people who that whole thing got turned towards them. So there, you know, there can be a real sense of terror and it's not so cavalier. But you're right. You kind of have to learn that these people, like, you can't target your work to them. You can't think about them. You can't write around them. You have to do what you want to do at the end of the day.
Yeah. Sometimes there has been a couple of instances where, I know, people have asked me to read something they wrote and have like a specific question about it. And just because of what the question was, my immediate follow-up question was, are you asking me this because you are insecure about the quality of the thing you're making? Or are you asking me because you are thinking about what people would say about it on Twitter?
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I had a freak out about that on LSBN, actually, specifically with like the, I don't know, the fact where, I don't know, this woman's in love with her boss. I don't know. Someone could just be like, this is glorifying sleeping with your boss or something.
I've been in that college classroom, actually. I've been in that classroom because like I tried to pick up going to school again, and I guess it was fall of 2021 and kind of a disaster, but I was in a women's studies class that was a lot about pop culture analysis. And there were a lot of those kids in there. I mean, I say kids because I'm 39 now. I was like 37 at the time or whatever. But, and they're like, I don't know, some of them were, a lot of them were coming straight out of high school to go to community college. And so they're 17, 18, 19, whatever. And they kind of, they have that viewpoint, right? That the morality of the piece, the morality of the people involved in the piece is determined by, you know, the content of it. And if you depict something, you are, and you don't immediately lay out like a didactic moral framework for it, you're endorsing it, you know? And there was a real knockdown drag out over blue is the warmest color, right? Because it's like, don't get me wrong here. I definitely don't endorse the director's behavior on set. But if you don't know about, but I think there's an integrity to the film, to the story, to the comic, you know, that's worth looking at. And it got into age gap discourse, right? And I was like, Jesus Christ, I guess this stuff happens in real life, right? I was like, God damn, here we are, you know, and because that is true in the comic as well. Even in the original comic, the age gap does appear, right? And I was saying to them, you know, sure, it's not great that this character is in high school. This one is college age, et cetera. But I was like, this is a phenomenon. This happens in the gay community. It happens in the gay community, it happens in the lesbian community. I would presume happens in the trans community. And if we don't depict it, if we don't show it, if we don't talk about it, however the media itself, you know, discusses it, we're never going to get anywhere on it. If we hide, if we pretend it's not there, if we get our hackles up every time we see it, nothing moves forward. You know, like, art is an opportunity to create conversations. Art is not a conversation. You know, and a few classes later, we were talking about something entirely different. And one of the people who was on the other side of it, you know, kind of came out and said, you know, I've been thinking a lot about what Emma said about age gaps and how, you know, we have to recognize what's in the world in fiction. And I was just like, okay, like, you know, I feel like it wasn't all in vain. You know, we can have these conversations when they're not on fucking Twitter.
Yes, yes.
And I also like kind of hate talking about it because it does come off as like cancel culture.
Yeah, we did finally find a way to cancel you.
Yes, finally.
Goodness, yes.
We've been trying.
My forbidden episode streak continues. There you go.
There is one other thing I do want to add on top of that, which is like, yes, art also exists to, you know, start a conversation, but art can also be like for fun. Like, I do not recommend sleeping with your boss. It seems like a messy situation, but like it can be hot and fun in fiction. And the thing that kind of drives me up the wall specifically about the, I don't know, I guess purity, insistence on purity in regards to like sexual stuff exists on like such this separate plane than everything else, because like, I don't know, you don't watch John Wick and then someone is like, so you think it's all right to kill 200 guys in a knife museum? It's just specifically with sex that, I don't know, people get weirded out, and like stuff can be explicitly fun because it is in a fictional context.
Well, that, I mean, like, that's why I'm a leather dyke, right? And that's why it informs so much of my art and stuff, because if you understand like what the structures and dynamics of like a proper healthy BDSM scene are, it's setting up those fences to be like, there are certain scenarios that have appeal, you know, that can be explored without those real world power dynamics getting involved or taking it over or making it toxic or violent. So you can have a secretary boss scene, right? You can have an incest scene. You can do age play. You can do all of these things in an agreed upon space that they don't leave. And so that kind of visceral thrill, that taboo, can be explored without it, you know, blowing up into the reasons why we don't want people banging their subordinates at work in real life, you know? And so like, stop me when I start like accidentally like quoting Tina Horan here, but it's just sort of like, you know, having that background now and having that understanding of like the way that the actual lived experience of sexuality can be without bleeding out in that way when it's properly managed. And it's like, well, what really is the problem with maintaining that same mentality towards art, that art is a safe, fenced off space for us to experience things and understand them better and explore them without having the actual consequences of them happening in real life? And I guess the answer to that is the evangelical church, in which everything has to be literal, but I digress.
You know, I've just really loved this conversation. I think we've gotten to such heights and depths. What do those mean? I don't know, but it sounds good. You know, we've really explored so many topics I didn't expect. I mean, I try not to have too many expectations coming into interviews because I'm always surprised, but this is another one that gave me a good, solid surprise. We'll wind down here in just a minute, but, you know, I can't let you leave without talking about your art a little bit. And, you know, I've got some kinds of questions. I listened back to our episode 79, where we made Trans Girls Hit the Town, our comic of the week. And something that we said there really stood out to me too with LSBN, which is you have this really great character design where your characters actually look like distinct people. We don't go like, wait, who is, like, wait a minute, like, am I looking at, which can happen in lots of different kinds of comics. We don't have to sip on Haterade, but you know what I'm talking about. And also your characters, their expressions, their the way their bodies move, the way they're set in panels, you convey such emotion, passion, and intimacy in your art. I'd love to hear a little bit about your character design process and then, you know, anything you want to share about how you developed your art style. And then don't worry, we're definitely going to talk about the colors too, because I'm pretty excited about that.
So as far as character design goes, oh man, I have so much insecurity about it. So it's wild to hear you say that, and I'm very happy about it. Yeah, part of it is explicitly in response to the thing that you've mentioned, where I have read comics where it's very difficult to tell who is who, and I explicitly want to avoid it. But part of it is just, I don't know, it's also a difficult needle to thread, especially when I'm drawing a lot of trans characters, because there's no like one right way to do it. But I remember like reading, I don't even know at this point, but I don't know, just pieces of media where trans women are drawn exactly like very idealized, sexy cis women. That just doesn't sit right with me, even though like there are trans women that look like that. It's great for them, but I don't know, trans women come in different shapes. Sometimes they kind of have wider shoulders and narrower hips, and it is difficult to want to incorporate that in a way that doesn't feel like a turfy political cartoon. So again, my really hot advice that you got to follow is feel it out.
I love it. I love it. You know, and to segue into talking about the colors a little bit, unlike your other works, LSBN has these wonderful, bold, neonish, I guess we'd say, colors that are provided by Sloan Leung, who is awesome and did these incredible, stunning colors. We also had the opportunity to interview Sloan in print on the website. Please go to bitchesoncomics.com, click print interviews, go read Sloan's interview. It is so insightful and cool. We talk about, oh, so much. It's very cool. I really love that interview. But I kind of want to know what it was like as the creator you are, seeing your art come back with these bright, bold, vivid colors.
It was, to be honest, absolutely terrifying. I was looking for a colorist for my comic, and I had a couple of people lined up, and they fell through for one reason or another. And I wasn't scrambling, but I was almost scrambling. I'm just like, man, who can I ask? I like, Sloan is an acquaintance. Surely this could not actually pan out. So I shot her a message, and I was asked, like, just absolutely floored when she said yes. Because I mean, I have several of her books. I especially was thinking of Prism Stalker, unsurprisingly, when I reached out to her, which is, if you're not aware, just these really vivid, gorgeous, now two sci-fi books that are great for reasons I won't even get into. You should probably read the interview.
Yes, we talk about Prism Stalker. No, I mean, that really, when I saw it was Sloan, I was like, oh, dang, okay. And then they immediately became like in conversation to me, you know, in very, like, very different takes on sort of the alien or the fantastical or what have you. But those colors really do, they bring so much to your story. I really love them.
Yeah, thank you. I'm really happy with them. And I had a lot of trepidation in asking Sloan to work on a comic that feels so much, I guess, fluffier than their usual stuff. Their work is very meaningful and impactful. And I feel like I walked up and was like, hey, I want you to color this cartoon where these two ladies fucking a robot. And
like, you have a trench coat on and you're like showing Sloan the line drawings.
Hey, I got some inks.
I love it.
I was curious about like what the conversations were like about establishing what the palette for LSBN was going to be, and kind of how the colors were going to flow through the comic, and kind of what that was like, you know, working with an outside colorist. But if I'm not mistaken, you haven't really done color work before, correct?
Yeah, not on work that both has my current name on it, and I'm confident enough to show people. And the process was more hands-off than you might think. It's not that I just said, Sloan, free reign, do whatever you want. Like, there was some fiddling around with, like, specifically the base colors for, like, the characters' different clothes and that kind of stuff that I was a little more picky about. But largely, I was like, Sloan, if you were just better... Okay, I didn't actually say this, but I thought this. Sloan, if it was, like, just that you were better than me at colors, then I might have more notes than I am currently giving you. But the fact that you, I don't know, your sensibility is so singular and so unique, I wouldn't even know where to begin to like impose my will upon it, you know, because almost nothing looks like colors that Sloan comes up with. And that's why I reached out to her, because I wanted it to stick out. And I was actually, when I first got the first round of colors back, I was kind of unsure what to think, just because, yeah, I've never, well, it's been a long time since I released something in color. And certainly I have never tried to release my work in color in a way that was so unorthodox, I would say. So I did have to sit on it for a little bit, but, you know, once I came back to it, it was just like, yeah, I mean, this doesn't look like a lot of other stuff. And that is more than I could ever hope for, I think.
Well, LSBN is the coolest. I hope that all of our listeners will take the time to head to Silver Sprocket, and either online or in person. I think if you're in San Francisco, it can be in person. But you know what? Go to their website. It's better than my brain. Who knows what I'm remembering?
They got a lot of cool books up there.
They
you
really
should buy stuff
do.
From Silver Sprocket.
Yes, we love Silver Sprocket. And we love Emma Jane. And we love LSBN because it fucking rules. So Emma Jane, I want to give you a quick chance to share with our listeners any social media handles, if you feel like it, or your website, or anywhere else they could learn more about you and your work.
So many forms of social media. Currently and in perpetuity, my plan is to just have the handle Emma Jane Comics, all one word. And I guess if you're looking at this podcast episode, you'll know that Jane is spelled with a Y. So I probably don't need to say this, but I have done it. But if you want to try to find me in a way that isn't a crapshoot, you could go to emma-jane-comics.com. And that will be just the hub for all the different places you can find me. So I should have led with that. That would have been a good move. But like, I don't know. If you look me up on co-host, I'm there. If you look me up on, oh, damn. Actually, I think my Tumblr handle is different. You know what? Go to emmajanecomics.com and you will find so many different. You'll be lousy with ways to see what Emma Jane is doing.
Amazing. And Veronique Emma Hubois, if folks want to learn more about you, your comics work, where can they learn more?
Well, I'm going to learn from the other Emma's mistakes. And I'm going to point you to houxbois.org, hubois.org. It's got all my comics. It's got stickers, prints for sale. I'm also on Patreon. Again, houxbois. I'm Emma Hubois on Blue Sky. I still have an account on Twitter, but don't try to find me there. It's pointless. Instagram, again, houxbois. It's all pretty streamlined, pretty focused. That's how you can find me.
Fantastic. Listeners, if you didn't have a pen handy or if you're driving a car, don't write it down when you get home. Or if you're not driving, hit the three dots next to the title of this episode, open that up, and I'll have hyperlinked to those handles for both Emma Jane and Veronique Emma Hubois, so you can make sure to follow them and learn more about their current work and upcoming work. You've both been an absolute delight today. My heart is full. I've got so much to think about. You know, I got to think about hot trans lesbians. Oh, what a hard life. I got to think about, you know.
So difficult.
Oh, gosh. You know what? I'm going to say it. I cannot stop thinking about the close-up panels on the nipples. Boom. I said it. I can't stop. I won't stop. I said it. Woo. I want to just thank Kate for making us sound fantastic, cutting out the moments we all forgot we were on a podcast. That was beautiful. You know, I know it's going to be beautiful because at the moment in time it exists at right now, it hasn't happened. But good job, Kate. I have full faith in you. Sarah and Monica, sending you all our love. Thank you for being the best co-hosts ever. Thank you to Priya Saxena for your fantastic interviews, including, I'm going to plug it again, your great interview with Sloan Leung, a wonderful conversation about volume 2 of Prism Stalker. Make sure you check out our website, bitchesoncomics.com, where you can listen to all of our episodes, read all of our interviews in print, and, you know, decide if you like us enough to join us on Patreon, because please do. All right. We love you, folks. Have a good one.
You're listening to Bitches on Comics, distributed by Realm, your portal to another world. Listen away. Find more shows like Bitches on Comics by following Realm on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or at realm.fm.
Thank you for listening to Bitches on Comics. We are a bi-weekly podcast where we talk to your favorite comics and pop culture creators and critics about what matters to them in comics and pop culture, as you might have guessed. You can follow us on Twitter at @bitchesoncomics and on Instagram at @bitchesoncomics. Our website is, brace yourself, bitchesoncomics.com. If you go there, you can listen to any of our episodes, and we've got other shit that we put on tabs. I don't remember what it is. I am in charge of updating the website, however, so good luck.
Thanks for the heads up. I'll go to this website now. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
You can also support the podcast by joining us on Patreon. Head to patreon.com/queerspec to learn more.
I'm Sarah Century, and you can find me at www.sarahcentury.com and Twitter and Instagram. Still Sarah Century on those.
I'm Essie Fleenor. You can learn more about me at essiefleenor.com. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at @SE_Fleenor.
I'm Monica Estrella Negra, and you can find me at www.audreysrevenge.com. or on Twitter at @AudreyRevenge.
Bitches on Comics is recorded by Kate Warner, who plays in the band Churchfire. You can find them at churchfiremusic.com. Our music is recorded by Katie Taylor, who plays as Earth Control Pill. You can find her music at earthcontrolpill.bandcamp.com.
Bitches on Comics is recorded in Denver, Colorado. We want to recognize the indigenous peoples who have inhabited and do inhabit this land. The Arapaho Nation, the Ute Nation, the Cheyenne Nation, and others who have been erased from our history and collective memories through colonization.